Welcome back to In Search of Tarot, a podcast that examines, questions, and reimagines our approach to life and the cards.
Through guest interviews and in-depth discussions, we'll explore and expand the beautiful complexities of spirituality, philosophy, magic, and more.
I'm Nick.
And I'm Angie.
And we're your hosts for this fascinating ride.
Thanks for being here with us.
My guest today is David Davis, a mystic, diviner, and artist currently based in Ypsilanti, Michigan. As an eclectic occultist and student of the Hoodoo tradition, his work is founded on the principles of animism and ancestral veneration. At its core, Porous Palms is a celebratory exploration of identity and place, and the ways they inform our most essential experiences as human beings. This mixture of influences manifests as a diverse and ever-evolving expression of divinity, language, and ritual, resting at the borders of personal and communal realities. Through his spiritual and educational endeavors, he seeks to contribute to the mending of intergenerational wounds, specifically those present within Afro-diasporic communities, by honoring the resilience of the human spirit and preserving the earth-based traditions of our ancestors. Along with offering services and classes, David also sells a curated selection of spiritual products at Porous Palms Apothecary. Before we launch into this wonderful conversation with David, I just have two quick things that I would love to share with you. The first is that I have opened my books for private tarot consultations through the end of October. Spooky season is my absolute favorite time of year to work with the cards, and it has felt wonderful to be back in this space reading for clients again after taking some time off in September. Between podcasting, writing, and working a full 9-to-5 job, which I do, my availability is extremely limited, so please be sure to book quickly if yours is too. Secondly, Angie and I are getting ready to host our October Tarot Hang on Patreon on Sunday, October 30th from 6 to 7:30 Central. Tarot Hangs are fun and casual opportunities to connect with other practitioners from all around the world, share a little bit about your life and experiences, and then work together to decide how we'd like to use the cards to gain further clarification and guidance. We really focus on being very communally minded in our practice during these hangs, and all of our discussions and interpretations happen together as a group so that we can learn from each other. Patrons of all tiers are always invited to these monthly hangs. So if you would like to support the show and make it possible for us to pay our wonderful guests, such as David, who you're hearing from today, and participate in a monthly tarot ritual, come join us at patreon.com/insearchoftarot. I'll put the link to our Patreon along with a link to book a reading with me in the show notes. All right, now on to my conversation with David Davis. Enjoy. David, welcome to In Search of Tarot. Thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you.
I'm very excited to talk to you. Your work is beautiful and rich, and I feel like just multi-layered. So I really am looking forward to diving into some of it with you. So as a way for our listeners just to kind of get to know you a little bit, I'm wondering if you can kind of root us in your present moment by describing a little bit about who you are and where you are in the world.
Cool. So I'm David of Porous Palms and Porous Palms Apothecary. I am in Ypsilanti, Michigan, so southeast Michigan, like an hour or so west of Detroit. So that's like where I am geographically. I'm a writer, artist, spiritual worker, educator, all those fun things. And then just as far as like my practice is concerned, or just like the spiritual elements that inform all of that work, it's a mix of like a folk magic practice, which is like primarily rooted in hoodoo. That's like my primary cultural framework. But there's also just like a wider sort of eclectic North American folk magic element as well. And then there's like the grimoiric side, which is primarily like planetary magic. There's not a lot of overlap, although there are minor overlaps between those two elements of my practice. That's where I'm at right now.
Were all of those things something that you grew up, you know, being surrounded by, or did you kind of find that on your own, or how did you come into the spiritual path kind of that you're on now?
Yeah. So hoodoo is, it's yes and no, right? So like hoodoo is, for those who are unaware, it's like I describe it as the cultural and like religious expressions of like Black American people, descendants of like enslaved Africans on this soil. And it's one of those things where, yes, of course, there are people and families and stuff that are very, or were and still are very intentional with the practice, like they're doing it on purpose. A lot of it is like a lot of folk practices and cultures in general, a lot of it is just very much like embedded into just the way you're raised and socialized, just like different taboos or ways of doing things or certain times that certain things are done. All of that kind of gets traced back to that larger culture that we share within the diaspora, or within this sort of like subset of the diaspora. And yeah, so I was raised in church, and hoodoo is very much like, it stems out of the Black church, or has like a deep connection to it. And so I was raised in church. Dad is an ordained minister, grandmother like owned the church that I grew up in. And you know, conversations about magic and stuff like that were definitely taboo. But as I'm sure like most people can attest to, the church is full of magic. It was commonplace just to have just like conversations about like spirits and their nature and how to engage with them, how not to engage with them. And so hoodoo was kind of like a full circle moment in a lot of ways, because like a lot of people, you know, like I rebelled. Especially as like a queer kid, I'm like, this isn't the place for me, and like I hate it here. And it still isn't. But like the culture within that, some of like the practices and beliefs and stuff like that, I definitely still like carry with me in my current practice. You know, obviously trying to like decolonize it as much as possible and sort of like bring it into the present day so it is more inclusive. The planetary stuff, that, and just like the grimoires in general, that was a way I stumbled across those kinds of texts and practices as part of like my rebellion journey, as I was sort of like expanding on that, because initially I was rebelling within like this like God Satan binary, and you know, like I didn't know that there were like other things out there. I was always interested in mythology and folklore and stuff like that, but I never really saw those as, at the time, I didn't see those as like legitimate foundations for a spiritual practice. I'm like, oh, these are just like stories. And so I didn't really look to those. But it was, you know, me looking into these grimoires, which tend to be very Christianized. It's a lot of, you know, like calling on this spirit in the name of God or whatever. And so it was like this way of me trying to reconcile my desire to work within like magical spaces without being like damned for all eternity, because I'm like, I'm doing it in the name of God. Like what could possibly be the problem? And so with a lot of like, you know, the Book of Moses and the Key of Solomon, all these figures that like I was taught about, and I'm like, oh, well, if they're doing it, it can't be bad. And so that's kind of where that came from.
It's interesting, folk traditions or roots of Christianity too, you know, and I'm wondering if you in your journey have felt tension at all between, you know, folk magic versus like more codified, you know, grimoiric magic, like what you're talking to, because I feel like that really tends to happen, like particularly, you know, among white Western occultists, where they sort of, you know, take these practices and then like codify them. But also I am not well versed at all in hoodoo or the tradition of hoodoo, but from what I think I've seen, you know, it seems as if that can also become initiatory or become sort of codified as well. So I'm just wondering if you feel tension between a folk magic perspective versus like ceremonial, you know, magic.
Initially, yes. From the very beginning of me exploring these grimoires, even before I knew about the like pre-existing intersections that already exist, where you have folk magicians who work with the planets, and like that's a big part of their practice. Before I even knew that that existed, I was kind of forced into that already, because, you know, obviously ceremonial magic tends to be, it was, you know, these are texts that were written by and designed for like wealthy people with a lot of space and time. And I'm just like in middle school and high school, and, you know, I'm practicing in secret. And so like I don't have, you know, this blade made from like a lion's tooth or whatever.
Yeah.
So I was forced to say, to read these texts and sort of bring them down to earth in a way, and sort of like look at and approach it from a more folky perspective. And so, yeah, there was definitely that tension, because I'm like, okay, well, if the purpose of magic as I'm perceiving it is to like address human issues in the moment, how am I supposed to reconcile that with this need to wait, you know, to fast for 3 years before I can, you know, like even start something, you know, start this month-long process of calling in like a guardian angel or whatever, right? And so, yeah, there was definitely that tension. Hoodoo is, it's very regional, and it's ultimately familial. And so like different families and areas will have their own way of doing things. So within those regions, yes, things can be very, like you said, like codified, and like this is how things are done. But for the most part, it's, you know, you're dealing with a tradition that was created and sort of preserved by people who were never really in one place for too long. Were sort of, you know, moved from one region to another, where there were different plants growing here than there were where they originally were. And so they kind of have to, it's all about adapting to where you are. And so, yeah, we're lucky now to be able to, you know, no matter where I go in the US, I can just like order an herb that I need or want. But before the internet and, you know, spiritual shops and stuff like that, it was kind of like, okay, well, what's growing around me? And even though I'm not used to using that, and I wasn't taught how to use that, and that technically isn't a part of my practice, it's all I have right now. And so like, how do I work with that? I hope that answered the question. I ramble a lot, so.
No, yeah, totally. Yeah. And I'm wondering for you where the line is, or if there is a line, you know, between like a folk magic lens versus like an appropriative, you know, approach. Like, how do you kind of see that?
Appropriative isn't like
you know, so you were sort of explaining, you know, that some of these practices you have to sort of take into a folk magic perspective, and I'm just wondering, like, you know, how one can, what the difference is, I guess, for you between a folk magic perspective versus like just appropriating a practice, you know.
Right. Well, there was and is a lot of overlap, cultural overlap, between like different groups of people, just throughout the US, right? You have the interactions between freed, enslaved people, you know, previously enslaved people who were freed or who ran away, and then the interactions that they had with the indigenous population that was already here, right? So you have like some cultural overlap there, and then you have cultural overlap between, you know, those groups of people and European immigrants from, you know, who settled in places like, you know, Appalachia. We settle like throughout Appalachia. And so there is a lot of overlap. And I think it's just about, just because, like I said, we have access to all of this information. I feel like that line being crossed is less understandable. Like you can kind of look back and see how someone, you know, would have used, someone who wasn't like indigenous would have used like white sage or something, because that's what was in the area, that's sort of what was pointed out to them as like good for this, that, or the other. But because I'm not in that place of, for lack of a much better term, desperation, mm-hmm. And I do have the luxury of being able to like pick and choose what I want to do, I'm not operating from a place of like, well, this is all I have, this is all I'll ever have, and so I kind of have to work with what I have. It's like I'm able to sort of look beyond that and look for those alternatives, even if they're not immediately available to me, through our modern lens, yes, there is a lot of appropriation, or there was, but even some of that wasn't appropriation. It was like these people were actually integrated into communities. Because ultimately, I think that's one of the things that helps us differentiate between what is and isn't appropriative. It's like, are you an outsider participating in this thing, or are you someone who has been, you know, formally, like I said, integrated into this community, and so now you have access to our medicines and our ways of doing things, our language, our stories, all that stuff. So
it makes me think too about like nature and like bioregions, you know, and like you're saying, like if you're an insider, if you're part of that bioregion, you know, maybe there's some overlap, and maybe that's different than if you're from way across the other side of the country, kind of just going on the internet, finding this thing, you know, like that's, it's interesting too, what you said, because there's both sides. There's the fact that we have technology that does, like you said, allow us to research these things and learn the histories and know where they come from. And that also means that we should maybe like take that knowledge, you know, and decide what our boundaries are, you know, within that. So that's very interesting. So you also on your website, you talk about that you work, your work involves healing intergenerational wounds and ancestral veneration. And I would love to hear you speak about that. You know, I think right now, a lot of people in the last year, I feel like are talking about working with ancestors, and some of those practices, you know, seem, you know, that I'm very drawn to, and some I feel like I question a little bit, you know. So I wondered if you would speak about your own ancestral practice and kind of what that involves.
Yeah. So the reason I made the Porous Palms like account and website and all that stuff was because I wanted to do two things. Well, it's technically one thing, but for two like separate groups of people. Because my primary framework is hoodoo, the healing of those wounds and the conversations about ancestors and ancestry are obviously going to be geared towards like African-American people first, or just people within the African diaspora. And so that's like the priority, but also I feel like a larger part of the work is also sharing these principles of how to find a cultural home and find a community, both like spiritual and, you know, cultural, sort of sharing those principles with other groups of people as well. And so like creating a platform where, yes, like because it's, you know, a space that is like sort of shared or through my lens, it's going to like sort of the communities that I'm a part of are going to sort of take center stage in a lot of ways, but also opening the conversation up for like non-Black people to look and sort of, I guess, be inspired to like do the same thing, to reconnect with where they came from. Cause I feel like that's where that healing comes in, the moment we start to divest from these like oppressive labels and sort of ways of being that have been forced onto us. And I feel like one of the ways to do that is through spirituality and finding out what our indigenous systems look like, and not just settling for what we've been told we are. And I feel like, yeah, that's of course like a big conversation that most of the energy, like through my work, most of that energy goes back into like the African diaspora, but I think it's something that everyone can benefit from. These are principles that everyone can sort of benefit from. And so that's what that work looks like for me, is just like opening up space for creating space for people to just reconnect with whatever it is they need to reconnect to in order for them to initiate that healing process for themselves, but also for the people that have come before them, who are now sort of spirits, their ancestors, right? Who are sort of like with us, but you know, they're still lost, right? Because they when they transitioned, they never had the opportunity to sort of have these types of conversations. That's kind of what that work means to me, and like what that language means to me, and how that kind of informs the things I do, the classes I teach, the things I write about, all that stuff.
Yeah. I want to ask you more about the ancestor work, and I'm not quite sure the best way to phrase this question, but I want to dig into it because I really do feel as a white person that there's a lot of white people out there doing ancestor work that I, like I said, I really feel strange about, you know, and just like really worry about. And so I guess what I want to ask you is like, how do you think someone can approach this in the best way? Or like what, you know, what is your approach, I guess, maybe to it? And particularly I'm trying to ask about not overlooking or sidestepping any like true harm that has occurred. You know, it seems like it really, I don't know. I guess I'm just trying to ask, like, how do you not just kind of, you know, look at the good stuff and not the bad stuff, basically, is what I'm trying to say. Or, you know, like what, how do you sort of get this work right, do you think?
We were all sort of born, raised, and socialized in this really messed up culture that is, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know, the Western world, if you want to just like focus on America specifically, like it's not great, right? Like it's founded on a lot of really heinous stuff. And a part of that, you know, those terrible things were sort of like I said, forcing these constructs onto people, the construct of race specifically. And my whole thing is, as race pertains to ancestor work, speaking directly to white people, the way I generally approach it is you have to acknowledge how the construct of whiteness informs your daily life, right? Like you can't, a part of reconnection is not erasing your whiteness, right? Because you can't, right? For as long as these systems exist, you're not going to be able to ethically erase whiteness or sort of like move away from it and sort of no longer identify with it. But it's about doing the work outside of that to, again, find out where you come from. Because I also feel like that's where a lot of appropriation stems from. It's like, I don't know where I come from. I don't know what those people did. I don't know how they sounded, what kind of music they listened to, how they dressed, what foods they ate. But I have this intrinsic human desire to connect to something larger than myself. But because I don't know how to do that, I'm just going to like steal from everyone else who already does, at least more than I do, because no one has it all figured out. But, you know, there are certain groups that have been doing it and never stopped doing it. And so that's kind of how I approach it. I feel like social justice work is a big part of ancestor veneration. It is a big part of healing those wounds. I see a lot of like ancestral healing jargon online, and a lot of it is like, it's all very meditative and conversational. It's like, let's sit with the trauma and sort of purge it out of our bodies by imagining it leaving out of whatever. And I'm like, okay, no, but like, you have to like boots on the ground, like do stuff, do like, not only set an example for your ancestors that it is possible for them to grow and heal, but you're putting yourself in a position to be a better ancestor yourself when you eventually transition, so that the people who may choose to honor or venerate you don't have to start from ground zero, like start from scratch in order to, you know, form a safe, mutually beneficial relationship with you. It's like divesting from the things that cause the harm, right? Divesting from the labels and the institutions that cause the harm without trying to divorce our daily lives from those things, because that's impossible for everyone, you know, that exists on a racial level, but also like on a gendered level as well. Like I say that, you know, like men, right? Like cishet men, cis men, like there's work that needs to be done ancestrally speaking on those fronts as well, as far as like healing is concerned and sort of figuring out what does healthy masculinity look like, right? And how is that expressed, right? How do I express my identity as a man or as a masculine individual without harming everyone around me, right? Without just completely, you know, like, so there, that's generally how I would approach that. It's like tangible action in your day-to-day life.
So we're recording this in September. And by the time this episode comes out, I bet you will have released who knows what other, you know, magical items. But right now you just recently released an ebook called Of Blood and Blade. And I want to talk a little bit about that. And it kind of goes along with this conversation. You describe this book as an introduction to the martial element, meaning the planet Mars. And you write something in the first section that I want to explore a little bit with you. So I'm gonna quote you to you for a second. You say, quote, "It is important to note that when working with Mars astrologically, the mythological aspects are separate from the archetypal qualities of the planet. Where the former aspect refers to any number of entities with their own cultural nuances and histories, the latter posits that the planetary body possesses an intrinsic essence practitioners can commune with both in transcendent ritual and daily life," end quote. What you said here is something that really concerns me, or that I think about a lot with tarot and also have always thought about with astrology. So I'm just wondering if you will kind of expand on this idea a little bit, you know, because I do think a lot about how we get locked into these sort of anthropomorphized visions of archetype, you know, and I really like what you said here. So I'd love you to just kind of open that up a little bit.
Yeah. So like a big part of how I approach planetary magic is, like I said, it's like you're working, it's a current, right? I use like the language of current in a very intentional way. Instead of viewing it as this anthropomorphized body, like you said, like Mars is not this Roman warrior, right? With the helmet and the sword and the shield. It's a space, right? It's a space that you can sort of exist in and immerse yourself in. And I feel like the same applies for all of the planets, right? All of the, you know, the traditional planets that I recognize in my regular practice, the seven traditional planets. And I guess, what was the question again? Like, I kind of went off on a tangent. I want to make sure I don't like go too far off.
Yeah, no, you're on. I mean, it's that difference between viewing it as a being, I guess, or a deity, like you're saying, versus sort of an energy or a current. And I guess as you're saying that, I'm curious, like, so I love that. First of all, I love that explanation that you just gave. And so for you, is it that when the planets are doing certain things, you know, making certain aspects, that field is kind of opened up? Or, you know, what is the relationship between the actual physical planet and that current that you're describing?
I feel like that's something that I'm still exploring, like to what extent, like, so, you know, there's the martial current, right? And sort of by working with Mars, yes, you're paying attention to the aspects, like you're paying attention to the fact that, oh, Mars is currently, and it's, you know, in air, not currently as of now, but like just hypothetically, like, oh, Mars is in Aries, right? So like its qualities are now sort of heightened or intensified because it's in its home sign, right? Or it's, you know, in a sign that's ruled by Venus. And so like, what does that look like? How does that, I kind of view it as like chemistry almost. It's like you have these seven vessels with, you know, that each vessel representing its own planet, and these vessels are filled with like very specific substances that are related to that planet. And so Mars for me is like very blood, it's bloody, right? And so it's like, you know, let's say like Mars's vessel is filled with blood and Venus's vessel is filled with, you know, some sweet like elixir of some sort. And so like what happens when you take a few drops of blood and add it to that elixir, or a few drips of that elixir and add it to that blood, what new thing is created? And so that's kind of how I look at that. I kind of view like the physical planets themselves as kind of just like avatars of that current, sort of like aspects of it that we can visually see and relate to and see how they relate to each other. But yeah, that's something I'm still unpacking. Like, to what extent does the actual red planet out there, what does that mean to me? Especially since, unlike the sun or even something like the moon, it has no immediate tangible effect on my life here, right? Like, if the sun stopped shining tomorrow, that would affect all of us, right? If the moon vanished, that would affect the tides. But if like Mars doesn't, as far as I know, I'm not, you know, astronomer, it doesn't do anything like in relation to Earth. It doesn't affect Earth in any tangible way. And so that's something that I'm still sitting with.
Thank you. I mean, thank you for that honesty. And you know, this also, I want to now kind of move into your herbalism work. And it also, I think, ties into that. I mean, I think in general, I think that it's very natural that as human beings, we do anthropomorphize things just to understand them a little bit more and like sympathize with it, you know. But even with plants, you know, like with trees and flowers and things, you know, sometimes I question anthropomorphizing those because I guess what I sometimes feel is like, what magic are we missing out on that we might not even understand? I mean, to me, it seems more magical to say that like a river, that I'll never understand a river, you know, that a river is nothing like a human, you know, rather than trying to sort of turn a river into a human, you know what I mean? So when you work with herbs also, you know, what is that relationship like for you?
It's a similar, it's similar in the sense that I also view like different plants or families of plants or types of plants as having their own current that usually for me exists within a larger current. And so like my work with teasel, teasel is a martial plant. It's thorny and there's a highly speculated carnivorous elements of teasel that people are still trying to like parse out and sort of figure out how real or true that actually is. But like there's the thorns and the sort of just like spikes of it. And it also, I also think about how the nature of a plant spirit can change based on its like where it is in its life cycle. Mm. And so like I thought about how I've only ever worked with teasel while it's already dead, right? Like those brown stalks you see as you're just like driving on the side of the road. I've only ever harvested teasel when it's in that form. But when I see it in its living form, it's less martial to me. I don't know where to place it when it's still alive. But I've been thinking about that as well. Like to what extent is like the life cycle of a plant or sort of like the current physical state of a plant affect what current it sort of exists in? There is a spirit of teasel, using that example, but like that spirit of teasel exists within something that is larger than it, right? It sort of exists alongside other plants, similar plants like thistle, for example. Even though they might not be genetically related, they still both kind of like exist in this similar currents of like very pointed, baneful medicine.
It's also kind of interesting that plants have a life-death cycle, mm-hmm. In a way that planets don't. Like, I mean, maybe one day Mars will die, but like there won't be another Mars, you know, like in the same way that these plants, you know, regenerate, which they're not the same plant, but it's the same, you know, species, which is kind of interesting. And you have a really good blog series called Wednesday Night Study Journal that I've been reading. And you talk in that about how you develop your relationships with plants. Will you kind of just kind of give us a feel for how you do develop these relationships?
Yeah. So when I first started I've always been curious about like just what's growing around me. I just, even being a little kid and just having access to like a pretty large backyard, and I'd just be like out pounding berries, never doing anything with it, not eating it, not doing, just like the act of just reaching into a bush and pulling something out and being like, there's fruit here, whether it's poisonous or not, who knows, I'm not gonna try this right now, but like there's something that's growing there that has a purpose. You know, I unfortunately, and I'm gonna use the word unfortunately, when I started my hoodoo practice, I kind of got away from that for a little while, like when I first started it. And I kind of fell into the consumerist spiral of like, you're reading these books and talking to these people, and there are all these like traditional hoodoo herbs that are used in these like, you know, different formulas and stuff like that. And you're like this, oh, like every time I walk into the spiritual shop, I walk out with like 3 ounces of something new, mm-hmm. right? And I did not form a bond with it. I kind of just knew that I quote unquote needed it. And so like I eventually went on, I would go on to form relationships with some of these like spiritual relationships with some of the plants that I had purchased, but I didn't really start to get back into going out and forming that bond with the earth that I walk on every day until like 2020. When I moved and I had access all of a sudden to a pretty robust, like inside of my apartment complex, a pretty robust, like natural landscape. literally right behind my building. And so it wasn't until I started to take those regular walks where I started to, you know, work with mullein and staghorn sumac and, you know, like Queen Anne's lace and really like all of the other things that grow and literally within like a 3-minute walk of my like front door from my front door. And so like the way the relationship for me is very much about like, I view education and learning about things as a way, as an offering. Even with my ancestor work, just the act of learning about where you came from is an offering to your ancestors. And so I take the same approach with plants as, you know, identifying them, learning their other names, right? You know, where we have these like Latin names for these different plants, but like, what if they don't want to be called that, right? Like, what if they have their own names that they identify with? And so learning those names, learning why that name, right? Like why someone would have called it that, where its medicinal properties, how does it engage with its environment? Is it invasive, right? If so, like to what extent, right? Is it actively harming the environment or is it kind of just there and it's not supposed to be? All of that stuff, right? Like that's the main way that I go about forming a relationship with that plant. And then there's the other stuff like watering them. I like to just talk to them, like when I'm walking by them and just like acknowledge their presence and, you're looking really pretty today, you know, mullein, right? Like you have new leaves coming in and I touch them and I'm like, good job, right? Like I'm glad to see that you're like growing and flourishing. I've recently also started to explore the idea of like the genus loci, like the spirit of a place. And that's a relatively new concept for me that it never really occurred to me. Before that, yes, there are these individual plant and animal spirits, but there's also the spirit of the place that they are growing and living in. And so engaging with that is another way that I found that the wisdom of these different plants sort of open themselves up more, because it's kind of like a quantifying weather or like adding, you know, but it's hard, I don't like the cold. But once it started to warm up, you know, more people were outside later. And I would get annoyed. Like I'm walking around and on my regular trail and I just see people out fishing and they are having the time of their lives. They are doing absolutely nothing wrong, but they're just like, I live off of a lake and they're just like fishing and they're on their boats and they're just walking around. And I'm like, I have to remind myself, this space, this is not my space.
Right.
Right. I may have my own relationship with this space, but this is not my space. I don't own it. Mm-hmm. And I have no desire to own it, but it's easy to fall into that pattern.
If you enjoy hearing conversations like this one, please consider supporting In Search of Tarot by becoming a member of our Patreon community. There you'll receive weekly mystic missives discussing any number of philosophical, tarological concepts, along with discounts to upcoming classes and workshops, and invitations to attend our monthly tarot hangs on Zoom. The financial support we receive through Patreon is the only way that we're able to pay our incredible guests who join us week after week to share their knowledge and life stories with all of you. We are so appreciative of our existing patrons' generous support, and we invite you to join them at patreon.com/insearchoftarot.
So let's move a little bit into the tarot portion, you know, of the evening to close out. So you also on your blog, you have an amazing series on the major arcana where you go through, you know, every card. And we don't have time, obviously, to talk about all of them, but I thought it might be interesting to explore the lover's card with you since 2022, you know, for some people is seen as a lover's year, it being a six, you know, reducing down to six. Yeah, talk about the lover's card. Talk about how you view this card, your relationship with this card, anything like that.
Yeah, so, you know, my first tarot deck was the Wild Unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And I read with that for a little while, but I didn't really start to connect not only with a single tarot deck, but with tarot as a medium until I got the Hoodoo Tarot by Tyana Lee McWhiller. And so a lot of like my conceptions of the different cards, even if I am reading with another deck, it's heavily influenced by the way she views those cards, because I think she does a really excellent job at like contextualizing a lot of those cards. And so my main like concept of the Lover's card is, you know, through the Hoodoo Tarot, which is it's courting, right? This idea of courting someone. And so for me, the Lovers, yes, there's you know, the literal interpretation of like romantic love and stuff like that, but there's also this idea of like strategic connection and commitment. And so you're not just falling into a relationship, whether it be romantic, platonic, professional, whatever, you're not just falling into it. It's something that you have to work to cultivate, and that cultivation process oftentimes looks like trying to convince the other party that you're worth it. And even if you're not convincing them per se, like what they may already be convinced, but sometimes, you know, we all kind of come from our own tribes, if you will, right? And so like, even if the two individuals, right, the two parties who are directly engaging with one another, they're like, okay, like I'm cool with you, you're cool with me, like I want to sort of link up, there's still the approval of the larger body that we come from. And approval might not be the right word, but it's kind of just like using romantic love as an example, but I feel like this applies to other types of relationships. Like my parents would tell me, like, when you marry someone, you're not just marrying that person, you're marrying their family,
right?
And so the same thing and everything that comes with that, right? All the good, all the bad, and all the just everything. And yes, of course, you can set those boundaries, but you can only set them so much, because you're literally engaging directly and intimately engaging with a fragment of that larger body. They can never really be fully divorced from that unless they make that decision to do so. And so that's kind of how I see the Lover's card. It's a card about connection and commitment, but also about like strategy and sweetening a situation to you, or sweetening someone, or just like another party to you. And so that's mainly how I view that card. And obviously that meaning gets tailored to the specific question of, you know, and the reading and all that fun stuff.
And then I'm curious if you, in your tarot practice, you know, have there been any cards, and maybe we can just focus again on the majors, or if there's a minor card as well, that you've either had a really strong bond with in an unexpected way, or and or if there's been one that's been, you know, really challenging for you to bond with or to get to know?
Yeah, there are two. Like one is the one where it was like immediate connection, like I really connect with this card. They're both majors. And then the other one where it was very difficult for me, even with the Hoodoo Tarot and all of its wisdom, it was still very difficult for me to wrap my mind around it. Like I could read the book and say like, okay, I know what this card means, but to put that into practice, that card, starting with the latter, was Temperance. It was almost impossible for me to understand what that card, I know what the word temperance means, I know what it means to temper something. Breaking down the symbolism of the card in different decks, I'm like, okay, this is great, but like, what does this mean, like in a reading or just like in my life, or in, you know, just in general? And so that card was really difficult for me to wrap my mind around. I did recently revisit the entry in the Hoodoo Tarot book. Because, you know, there's the obvious stuff about balance and sort of like, you know, with the Rider-Waite-Smith imagery, there's like, they're all four elements are visible or sort of present in the card. And so like, the way I view that, you have stuff like the World and the Magician. Whenever all four elements are present, there's this idea of like mastery of everything, whether that's a pre-existing mastery or a mastery that you're working towards, but like there's, everything is there, right? And everything can be engaged with. This card isn't just one element, even though technically it may be, but that's just not how I view those cards. So the Hoodoo Tarot, it's a card about balance, but more so about viewing things from different perspectives. The specific figure that's on that card is Father Sims. They were a preacher and a root worker, a conjurer in New Orleans. And they were very eccentric, and they were known for being able to read any situation, and they felt entirely comfortable leaning into like the right hand and left handed paths of hoodoo. And so it's this card about like not leaning too heavily into a binary way of thinking, like everything has to be done this way or everything has to be done that way. It's about approaching every situation based on what is needed for that situation and bring those tools to the table. And so it's, for me, temperance is a card about like adaptability and yeah, just sort of like breaking out of that like binary way of thinking. And then the other card that was just like an immediate click for me was the Chariot. Again, like I'm a very fiery person. I find a lot of value in the element of fire, specifically through like the context of like Mars and like the martial space. And so the Chariot card was just like a very obvious choice for me because, and that really didn't start until after I had this like personal revelation that Mars was a very effective like road opener energy. Just for it's this like brute force that kind of just like thrusts forward and just like breaks through any obstacle that's in front of you. And so like the Chariot for me is very much that as well. But again, going back to the Hoodoo Tarot, the figure on that card is a folk hero, an African-American folk hero, kind of like a Black Robin Hood figure, Railroad Bill. And he was just like ride around. There was rumors that he was a shapeshifter. And that's how he was able to evade the authorities for so long, because he would like transform into like a fox or a whatever and just like run off. But he would ride these trains all over the country and steal from them, like take goods from them. He like single-handedly ruined like the economy and like an entire part of the country, because he would just like take things from these trains, like all the stuff, all the produce or whatever, and give it to poor families in the area. And people would just wake up with like food on their front door.
Wow.
Yeah, there's that brute force element of like the train imagery, just kind of like going. But again, there's that mutually beneficial trickster energy as well, that the Chariot for me also embodies because of the way that it's framed within the Hoodoo Tarot. So those are like my big two cards that I spend a lot of time like really studying.
Yeah, I feel like the word current that you've been using a lot could apply for the Chariot.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. So to close, there's a question I've kind of been asking all of my guests this season, which is, what are you searching for right now in your life?
A foundation. Like, I'm in a period of transition, just like professional transition, but also like spiritual transition, and just like in the process of reframing a lot of things and giving language to things that previously didn't have language sort of attributed to it in my personal life and practice. And also, like I said, just like reframing some of the language that I did already have, and then just like using all of that to build a new foundation that I can grow from. And just, yeah, just trying to find a way to exist and do this work in a way that's sustainable, but also in a way that allows me to sort of still maintain a sense of rest. Rest is very important to me. And so finding a way not to just like go, despite like my favorite card being the Chariot, finding a way to counter that, and finding time to just like sit and take stock of things and just see what the next steps are.
Yeah, they don't make that easy for us, you know. Well, thank you so much, David. I want to let you tell everyone how they can follow you and find you and work with you. If there are any offerings you want to talk about, or I think you have a Patreon maybe, you know, to tell people about. So just share all the things with everyone so they can find you and follow you.
Cool. Yeah. So I'm pretty much everywhere, just at Porous Palms, Twitter, Instagram. There's porouspalms.com, which is where I offer the classes and services and stuff like that. So I do readings and custom sigils for people. I teach classes about ancestor work and ritual crafting and stuff like that. And then there's Porous Palms is the theory, and the study and the education, and then Porous Palms Apothecary is like the application of that. And so it's like the tangible manifestation of all the things that I write about and talk about and stuff like that. And so that's where you can get your seasonal spiritual products and stuff like that. Porous Palms and Porous Palms Apothecary on all the platforms. And then, like you said, the Patreon as well.
Amazing. Well, I really can't wait for everybody to discover your work. Anyone that's listening to this that hasn't yet, because there's just so much. I mean, there's so much you do and so much you offer. I'm excited for the world to discover you. And thank you again for this awesome conversation.
Thank you.
In Search of Tarot is independently written, recorded, edited, and transcribed by Nick Kepley and Angie Miller. You can follow Angie on Instagram at birdgirl_, that's BIRDGERHL_, and you can follow me, Nick, on Instagram at In Search of Tarot. Have a question or a comment? Email us at isotpod@gmail.com. We also invite you to leave us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.